focus on the more familiar passage from Matthew, that we would perhaps focus a little bit today on Isaiah. It would be good, I think, for us, because for many of us, Isaiah is unfamiliar. I think it would be good now, actually, to have a look at the book of Isaiah. I don't know if anyone, Peter and Caitlin, do you mind just grabbing some of those Bibles that are at the back? There's a sort of a stack. There is sort of one on each row, but there might be a few other people who just might like to grab a Bible if they don't have one to hand. Perhaps if you just go down the side aisles and see if anyone else wants to pick up a Bible. So if you turn to Isaiah, you'll find it fairly near the middle of the Bible. If anyone's in Isaiah, can you sort of give a page number? Gene,
700.
700, yeah. So around page 700, is that where it starts?
No, Tim?
Okay, lovely. Lovely. 692 is where Isaiah starts. Okay. And you'll notice, if you just start flicking through it, that it's quite a long book of the Bible. Lots of chapters. 66 chapters. And it's written in a style that you might find a bit challenging. It actually chops and changes the way it's written. And you see it's laid out. I don't propose that we're going to read it all now, but you might just want to refer to it as we go through the next few minutes together. So, as I said, I do have a video to show you, but I thought before I did that, it was important that we should just remind ourselves of what I would say is perhaps the first rule of understanding and applying the Bible. And that is to understand the type of literature it is that we're reading and the context in which it's written. So it's the type of literature and the context. I think, you know, we do this naturally anyway in life. We realize there are different types of writing. We're inclined to think, though, that the Bible is just all the same, but it's not. The Bible is a library. If you go into a library, there are lots of different types of literature, and the same in the Bible, you get lots of different types of literature. And so where you open it gives you a different sort of type of writing that we're looking at, and you'll understand it in a different way. So a quick quiz then, just before we start, on different types of literature. So I've got four examples of literature that I could pick off a shelf at home and start reading. Okay, and I want you to tell me what type of literature it is. Okay, so they could all come off the same shelf. First piece of literature, here we go. So, put all the fruits in a bowl and mix them with brandy. Cover with a cloth and leave them to soak for a minimum of 12 hours. Right, what type of literature is that? It's a cookbook. It's a recipe, isn't it? In fact, it's a recipe for Delia Smith's classic Christmas cake. The beginning of it, that is. There's a bit more to go. Great. Second one. Marley was dead, to begin with. There is no doubt whatever about that. The register of his burial was signed by the clergyman, the clerk, the undertaker, and the chief mourner. What type of literature is that? Simeon? It's Gothic. Wow, we're quite detailed. It's Gothic literature. Indeed it is. So it's more generally, it's a novel, isn't it? It's fiction. And which novel is it? Do you know? It's A Christmas Carol. Exactly, by Charles Dickens. Okay, your third piece of literature. I'm putting it off the shelf and reading it. A couple of English brought a football out of their trench and a vigorous football match began. This was all so marvellous and strange. What type of literature is that? It's history. It's an eyewitness account of a Christmas Day football match between German and English soldiers in Flanders in 1914. Okay, so your fourth and final piece of literature I'm pulling off the shelf. Last Christmas I gave you my heart, but the very next day you gave it away. This year, to save you from tears, I gave it to someone special. It's a song. It's a love song. Last Christmas by George Michael. So all off the same shelf, we have a recipe, we have fiction, we have history, we have a love song. We read them differently to each other, don't we? We believe that the football match actually happened, but we don't believe that Marley ever really existed. We literally mix together the dried fruits, but we don't for one minute believe that one of George Michael's internal organs was being passed around this time last year. different types of literature have different purposes. We read them in different ways and we understand them differently. So what type of literature is the book of Isaiah? What we've already said, it's a prophecy. I mean, what that means needs a bit of unpacking, but it's a prophecy. It's a message from God through a human messenger. And it's actually rooted in an actual place and an actual time in history. So Isaiah was the son of a man called Amos. He was married and he had at least two sons. And he lived in Jerusalem around 700 years before Christ. He was prophesying probably for around 40 or 50 years from around 740 BC. Okay, so he was a person who lived in a particular place in a particular time and he had a message from God. So that's the setting, that's the type of literature. But what is the prophecy about? And this is what we're going to spend a bit more time thinking about in a few minutes. So in two words, I'll give you two words to summarize the prophecy. It is judgment and hope. Judgment and hope. So in a nutshell, Isaiah announces that God's judgment is coming, but that it will purify Israel, God's people, and prepare his people for the coming messianic king and for a new Jerusalem. So I'll read that again. So Isaiah announces that God's judgment will come, but that it will purify Israel and prepare his people for the coming messianic king and the new Jerusalem. So we're going to have a video. Hopefully it's going to work. It's quite fast. It's from a website called the Bible Project. A really good resources, really good videos. At the end of their videos, they often produce a picture or a scheme, and I've got a copy of it here, which can be downloaded. As I say, it is quite fast. There's quite a lot packed in. Just try and stick with it. You can go back and look at it again if you want on the website. This is at least A level. This is probably degree level. Okay. So if you follow this, you're doing really, really well. All right. But it's a little overview of the message of Isaiah.
Book of the prophet Isaiah. Isaiah lived in Jerusalem in the latter half of Israel's kingdom period, and he spoke on God's behalf to the leaders of Jerusalem and Judah. He spoke, first of all, a message of God's judgment. He warned Israel's corrupt leaders that their rebellion against their covenant with God would come at a cost, that God was going to use the great empires of Assyria and after them Babylon to judge Jerusalem if they persisted in idolatry and oppression of the poor. But that announcement was combined with a message of hope. Isaiah believed deeply that God would one day fulfill all of his covenant promises, that he would send a king from David's line to establish God's kingdom, remember 2 Samuel 7, that he would lead Israel in obedience to all of the laws of the covenant made at Mount Sinai, remember Exodus chapter 19, and all of this was so that God's blessing and salvation would flow outward to all of the nations, like God promised to Abraham in Genesis chapter 12. And it's this hope that compelled Isaiah to speak out against the corruption and idolatry of Israel in his day. Now, the book has a pretty complex literary design, but there's one simple way to see how it all fits together. Chapters 1 to 39 contain three large sections that develop Isaiah's warning of judgment on Israel. And it all culminates in an event pointed to at the end of chapter 39, the fall of Jerusalem and the exile of the people to Babylon. But in chapters 1 to 39, there's also a message of hope that after the exile, God's covenant promises would all be fulfilled. And chapters 40 to 66 pick up that promise of hope and develops it further. In this video, we're just going to focus on chapters 1 to 39. The first main section focuses on Isaiah's vision of judgment and hope for Jerusalem, and it begins as Isaiah accuses the city's leaders of covenant rebellion, idolatry, injustice, and God says he's going to judge the city by sending the nations to conquer Israel. Isaiah says that this will be like a purifying fire that burns away all that's worthless in Israel in order to create a new Jerusalem that's populated by a remnant that has repented and turned back to God. And Isaiah says that that's when God's kingdom will come and all nations will come to the temple in Jerusalem and learn of God's justice, bringing about an age of universal peace and harmony. Now, it's this basic storyline of the old Jerusalem purifying judgment into the new Jerusalem. This is going to get repeated over and over throughout the book, getting filled in with increasing detail. So, at the center of this section is Isaiah's grand vision of God sitting on his throne in the temple. And he's surrounded by these heavenly creatures that are shouting that God is holy, holy, holy. And Isaiah suddenly realizes just how corrupt he and his people Israel are. And he's certain that he's going to be destroyed by God's holiness. But he's not. God's holiness, in the form of this burning coal, comes and burns him, but not to destroy. Rather, it purifies him from his sin. And as Isaiah ponders the strange experience, God commissions him with a very difficult task. He is to keep announcing this coming judgment, but because Israel has reached a point of no return, his warnings are going to have a paradoxical effect of hardening the people. But Isaiah is to trust God's plan. Israel is going to be chopped down like a tree and left like a stump in a field. And that stump will itself be scorched and burned. But after all of that burning, God says that this smoldering stump is a holy seed that will survive into the future. It's a small sign of hope, but who or what is that holy seed? The rest of this section offers an answer. Isaiah confronts Ahaz, a descendant of David and a king of Jerusalem, and he announces his downfall. God says that it's the great empire of Assyria who will first chop Israel down and devastate the land, but there's hope. Because of God's promise to David, he's going to send, after this destruction, a new king, named Emmanuel, which means God with us. And Emmanuel's kingdom is going to set God's people free from violent, oppressive empires. And Isaiah describes this coming king as a small shoot of new growth that will emerge from the old stump of David's family. It's this king that's the holy seed from chapter 6. And the king is going to be empowered by God's Spirit to rule over a new Jerusalem and bring justice for the poor, and all nations will look to this messianic king for guidance. His kingdom will transform all creation, bringing peace. Now, you finish chapters 1 through 12 with a pretty good understanding of Isaiah's message of judgment and hope. But when will this all happen? Isaiah saw another empire arising after Assyria, and that's Babylon, who would also attack Jerusalem and actually succeed in destroying it. And that brings us into the next sections of the book. So first, we have a large collection of poems that explore God's judgment and hope for the nations. We learn, first of all, of the fall of Babylon and Israel's neighbors. Isaiah could see that Assyria's world power would one day be replaced by the empire of Babylon, a nation even more destructive and arrogant. And Babylon's kings claimed that they were higher than all other gods, and so God vows to bring Babylon down. And not only Babylon. Isaiah goes on to list Israel's neighbors, accusing them all of the same kind of pride and injustice, and he predicts their ultimate ruin. But remember, for Isaiah, God's judgment is never the final word, for Israel or the nations. And that leads into the next section, with a series of poems that tell a tale of two cities. There's the lofty city that has exalted itself above God and become corrupt and unjust. This city is an archetype of rebellious humanity, and it's described with language that's all borrowed from Isaiah's earlier descriptions of Jerusalem and Assyria and Babylon all put together. This city is destined for ruin, and one day is going to be replaced by the new Jerusalem, where God reigns as king over a redeemed humanity from all nations, and there's no more death or suffering. These chapters are the climax to this section, and it shows how Isaiah's message pointed far beyond his own day. It was a message for all who are waiting for God to bring his justice on violent, oppressive kingdoms, and bring his kingdom of justice and peace and healing love. The following section returns the focus to the rise and fall of Jerusalem. And first we find a whole bunch of poems where Isaiah accuses Jerusalem's leaders for turning to Egypt for military protection against Assyria. He knows this will backfire. And Isaiah says that only trust in their God and repentance can save Israel now. Which gets illustrated by the following story about the rise of Hezekiah, king of Jerusalem. Just as Isaiah predicted, the Assyrian armies come and try to attack the city. And so Hezekiah humbles himself before God, and he prays for divine deliverance, and the city is miraculously saved overnight. But Hezekiah's rise is immediately followed by his fall. So he hosts a delegation from Babylon, and he tries to impress them by showing everything in Jerusalem's treasury and temple and palaces. It's clearly an effort to make another political alliance for protection. Isaiah hears about this, and he confronts Hezekiah for his foolishness. He predicts that this ally will one day betray him and return as an enemy to conquer Jerusalem. And we know from 2 Kings chapters 24 and 25 that Isaiah was right. Over 100 years later, Babylon would turn on Jerusalem, come and destroy the city, its temple, and carry the Israelites away to exile in Babylon. And so all of Isaiah's warnings of divine judgment in chapters 1 to 39 lead up to this moment. He's shown to be a true prophet because it all came to pass, like he said. But remember, the purpose of God's judgment was to purify Jerusalem and bring the holy seed and messianic kingdom over all nations. And it's that hope that gets explored in the next part of the book. But for now, that's what Isaiah chapters 1 to 39 are all about.
So it's pretty simple, really, isn't it? I expect your head is probably spinning, and your ears might be ringing as well. I apologize for the sound. I don't know why it was so bad. There was a bit of an echo going on somewhere, I think. If you did want to have a look at that again, as I say, it is available online, and you can keep pausing it. I think it's quite helpful. He speaks quite fast as well, doesn't he? If you want to sort of keep pausing it, I think it's really helpful. Isaiah is a complicated book. It's got quite a complicated structure. So if you can get your head around Isaiah, I think you can pretty much get your head around any of the biblical books. So do have a look at that if you're inclined to. It's easy to find online, Bible Project, and then just look up Isaiah. But just really a few comments to close. So like Elijah, Jeremiah, and the other prophets, Isaiah had a message. He was called by God to deliver this message to Israel, but also to us. It was a message that was given for the welfare of God's people and for the wider world. So along with the warnings against Israel's sin and rebellious ways came that message of hope. And that message then sort of carries on really for centuries beyond the time of Isaiah. The hope would be embodied through God's servant, known as Emmanuel. And that servant would one day establish a new Israel and God's kingdom on earth. This is the promise. Jesus of Nazareth, as we know, turns out to be that Messiah, fulfilling the prophecies of the Bible, including those intricate prophecies in Isaiah 50 to 53, those really important prophecies about the death and resurrection that are foretold. So another time, I think we'll come back and think more about the second half of Isaiah. There's a real focus there on that future hope. It's written from the perspective of the other side of the exile, sort of looking back, but is also looking forward to a hope. And it opens with those famous words, "Comfort, comfort my people, says your God." Those are the opening verses of chapter 40, the second half of Isaiah's prophecy. But even the first half of that great book, we have all those pointers towards God's purposes, the hope alongside the judgment, the passages that we read from Advent, are all taken from the first half of the book. We hear of God's incredible plans of a judgment, but also of hope, focused on and brought about by God's Messiah, Jesus. So for centuries, Isaiah's words have encouraged those who feel like they're living in a land of darkness, those who are in dark places, who are without hope, who are needing the comfort of God. And this is something which can be found, I think, in the book of Isaiah, which very clearly points to God's Messiah. With Christmas just around the corner, let's continue then to reflect on this these great truths that Isaiah speaks about, these great promises fulfilled in the New Testament with the arrival of Emmanuel. The virgin will conceive and give birth to a son and will call him Emmanuel, which, as of course we know, means God with us. We're going to sing of the arrival of Emmanuel.